I'm interested in the way people think and the way they use emotions and behaviors, and persons with mental illness are fascinating. And so I met my first people with serious mental illness during med school and really enjoyed seeing how ways that you can help them and work with them. And I was hooked. And ever since then, I've been privileged to be involved in psychiatry.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I've heard a lot of great things about you, and your reputation precedes you. Now, kind of a funny fact I want to get out of the way before we get down to the serious business of our topic today is you told me off air that you do not own an actual cell phone or smartphone. Is that correct?
Tish, that was off air. But yes, it's true. I don't own a smartphone. Yeah, I am one of the holdouts.
Okay, so you're a doctor that doesn't own any form of technology in that regard. You know that's an oxymoron, right?
It does, right? I mean, I am as tech-hungry as everybody else, right? I like kind of the bells and whistles of those things. But I think in med school, the prospect of being given a pager and always being available to things made me think, why would I want to do that in my personal life?
Right, exactly.
There's some time to tune out.
Absolutely. And which leads us into the first part of our interview this morning. So the fact that you take solitude and take a break and intentionally, you know, kind of just, you know, cast aside technology and being on call literally all times of the day, even in your personal life, I think gives a credit to your way of thinking when it comes to mental health. What would you say is some of the biggest changes you've seen since our election results back in November 8, as far as the general congregation is concerned?
Yeah, part of my decision about not having a cell phone is that I think I should be attending to the person in front of me rather than to the person who's somewhere else in an abstraction that's communicating with me. And for about 8 months, but I go back and forth on that idea. And for about 8 months, I tried Twitter. And I would get up in the morning, first thing, read my Twitter feed, start engaging my Twitter feed, read the newspaper, and start tweeting out. And as the election, it happened that I was doing it just as the run-up to the election. And I started to realize the kinds of ways that I was interacting with people. And on Twitter, I found that I was interacting with people mostly who had similar beliefs to my own, and they would endorse them and confirm them. Or I'd interact with people who had different beliefs of my own, and I would have encounters that were much worse than I thought I would have in person, where we didn't understand each other. And so I ultimately left Twitter because I felt like the election was decided through those kinds of platforms rather than through face-to-face encounters.
And did you find those platforms like Twitter somewhat limiting and not giving you the full scope of the mental condition of the human beings that you were speaking with?
I did, right? That kind of full sense of things. We're in a DJ studio, right? And Louis Armstrong always talked about how he likes to give every record his particular stink. Mm-hmm. Right, that idea that you give it your particular flavor, your particular feeling. People come in all sorts of different ways, the way they look, the way they smell, the way they touch, the way they sing, the way they move through the world. They have bodies. And a lot of times technology reduces them just to these kind of brief kind of thoughts.
Do you think that social media in general has contributed to people becoming desensitized, especially in this environment over the last several months, which is kind of an unintended consequences of what's happened with the election? But do you think because of the results, people's heightened sense of morality from one spectrum to the other has been over-amplified and somewhat, I would say, probably leaned on too much through social media? People have become somewhat intellectually lazy. You know?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it's not so much, there's the laziness to it, but also there's a compartmentalization to it, that you tend to go towards sources that reinforce what you already believe. So if you have one political opinions, you get up in the morning and you turn on PR, and if you have another, you turn on Fox News. And it winds up confirming things rather than challenging you. One of the most best signs of an interesting mind is somebody who can entertain competing ideas and see both sides or multiple sides of a story. Today's media discourages that. It encourages these quick, emotional, kind of gut responses that drive you into the group that you already identify with, rather than challenging you to see the world more broadly.
So it basically creates a silo, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And to a comfort zone that you're already aligned with, so it just reaffirms that.
It does, and I think it maps onto these other kind of social problems where people are living in those silos. There's all sorts of social data that people are living in neighborhoods of people who are like them. They're going to educational institutions, religious institutions, cultural institutions with people like them. It reminds you of Martin Luther King's famous quote, right? Sunday morning's the most segregated time in America. But now, today, it seems like it's every day, right? People live in neighborhoods with people like them, in towns and states. There's all sorts of data from the election of these rural and urban divides. And the sense on both sides is they don't understand me and my life.
So from a psychological standpoint, what would you recommend in general? I mean, not providing a diagnosis, but what would your advice be for people in general to try to overcome that or take steps forward into challenging themselves and trying to become more open and providing more grace into areas and people they don't understand?
I favor random encounters. I was listening to this podcast last week about a guy who is on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook for some of the similar reasons, but he decided to re-engineer his Facebook feed so that he would go to a random event within 5 miles of him. And he just found that he would go to people who were very different than himself, and yet they would often welcome him. And I would strongly encourage people to think about getting outside their comfort zone and meeting people who they perceive to be different than themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Now, we have heard a lot of views back and forth, we have heard people say, you know what, I have been so upset about what's going on in our culture as a byproduct of what's happened since November 8th. I've been to my doctor, I've talked to my priest, I've talked to family members, I've talked to friends. I can't quite shake this sense of fear or sadness or, you know, jubilation. I have seen personally both sides of the spectrum where people are really, really happy about what's going on or they're really, really upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen that the emotional cultures have divided quite divisively, and I've seen very little that's in the middle.
Yeah, Tish, I appreciate that. I think we all have. I have friends I know who couldn't get to sleep the night of November 8th, and some of them with celebration and some of them with just a sense of dread. How could this happen? I talked to a professional colleague of mine last week, and he said, I'm surprised somebody hasn't tried to kill him. And he said it in such a way that he was unclear whether that he thought that was a good thing or not. And that's a worrisome sign to me. So I would say that that's part of why I think people have to get outside of their group and get outside of these kind of media narratives that push them further into their groups. One of the things I tell my children is that advertisers, and there are a lot of them in our lives, and the media is a part of that, want to push you into a definable group so they can sell you something. And part of that's ideas. I'm always interested in people. It's why I chose psychiatry as a medical field. It's why I've stayed there, because I am surprised by people who are very different than myself.
And quite frankly, differences is what makes Denver and Colorado and the rest of our nation very eclectic and very wonderful in many ways. So in such a divisive culture right now, how do we celebrate that and still appreciate the values of people that don't look like us or come from the same origin as we do or have different faiths or different religions, and still try to find some common ground in giving grace and kindness to each other with people being so divided right now?
Well, Tish, I think listening to you is a good start. Those are some lovely things. Some grace and kindness seems like a great start. I guess for me, after the election, I've done a couple things. One is that I started thinking about the communities in which I belong and tried to find ways to engage different communities. The second is that I've been reading some, and that probably reflects the fact that I'm a bit of a nerd, but I'm a doctor. So one of the things that I've been reading is a book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind, which is a book I would recommend to somebody who wants to understand some of the ways that people think in today's world. And it's a book about how we make decisions and how people join groups and think through problems like the election.
Now, the election in itself has, had lingering effects, and I think we've kind of drilled on that a little bit. What would you recommend for people long term as far as taking not just the election as an excuse to either be divisive or, you know, promote negative things, or be on the other side of the spectrum and be hyper vigilant about the state of politics, you know, whether it's in their favor or against their favor. What would you recommend for people to do? Not just, you know, not as a doctor, again, not, you know, providing, you know, medical advice, but just what would you say to someone that comes up to you and say, look, I don't get what's going on. I'm confused. This divisive rhetoric is just has me all turned upside down. I'm not quite sure who to talk to or who I can trust.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It is hard for me to offer medical advice to everybody, right? Doctoring is a one-by-one kind of business. We see one person at a time. But in my own personal life, what I've tried to do is to leave behind things that make me feel divisive. So I always ask myself, is this media designed to keep me engaged, right, by making me feel that somebody different than myself is my enemy? Or is that I can't understand them? And there's people that I've liked. There's some authors that I've liked that I've then said, you know what? Every time I read this guy or this woman, they make me feel bad about the world. And so I leave it away, which isn't to say that I'm exiting the world or I'm not trying to be engaged and know what's going on. But I'm asking, how is this work engaging me emotionally? And is it bringing me closer to the strangers in my life? Or is it pushing me further away? Because what I don't want is to be told that somebody who's not like me is, because they're not like me, is bad.
Very good thought, Doctor. And I appreciate that, because we need to try to keep an open mind, especially in these days and times when people are so dug in their position. And we need to make sure that we promote grace and patience and kindness as much as possible. You're listening to KGNU Community Radio. I'm your host, Tish Buford. In studio today, we have Dr. Abraham Nussbaum, the chief educator from Denver Public Health. He is in studio with us for another 15 minutes this morning, talking about the state of mental health in Denver and in the state of Colorado and throughout the country. Now, we want to segue into another part of what's going on in our nation's capital, which is the rewrite of the ACA. Now, I want to talk about how that's going to affect the citizens here in Denver, and particularly those consumers and citizens that frequent Denver Public Health.
Yeah, thanks, Tish. I work at Denver Health, just a couple blocks from here. I've worked here ever since I came back to Colorado 8 years ago. It's been an absolute privilege. During my time at Denver Health, I've seen a dramatic change through the ACA. In particular, while there's some parts of the ACA I don't like, it needs to be improved, the most helpful thing has been the expansion of Medicaid. I am so grateful that the citizens of Colorado accepted the Medicaid expansion. When I started, more than half the patients I saw had no insurance, and we would hospitalize people who were profoundly ill, and then often discharge them with little more than a prayer and some referrals to some resources they could try to scrape up. Since the rollout of the Medicaid expansion within the ACA, that's really not the case anymore. We're consistently able to get people into some resources. We fear, while it's unclear entirely what the Senate version of the health care reform bill will have, most people suggest that it will roll back the Medicaid expansion. To me, that's the most important part of the ACA, was the Medicaid expansion. If you go back and look, in Denver Health, before the Medicaid expansion, over half the patients had no insurance. Today, less than 5% at Denver Health have no insurance. That's a dramatic change for us.
That is very dramatic. Now, with talks of the Medicaid expansion being rolled back, how would that affect the consumers here in Colorado and other citizens throughout the country?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look in my own field of mental health, right, most counties in Colorado don't have any mental health provider at all today. Mental health services tend to be located in urban communities. But even in urban communities, oftentimes the largest providers of mental health services are people in the jails, especially before the ACA. The largest psychiatric facility in the state of Colorado is the Denver County Jail, because historically we haven't provided care for persons with serious mental illness. The ACA helped to move us towards that. If we go backwards on that, it's part of what drives homelessness, it's part of what drives people moving into the jail system instead of treatment, It keeps people out of substance abuse treatment. And we know that treating mental illness and treating substance abuse can dramatically improve people's lives and the lives of the people who know and love them.
And to that point, would you say from a mental health standpoint, if you were to put maybe just a percentage on it, how many patients would you say from a percentage standpoint were helped, or how much did that increase after the ACA was passed?
For the patients I see?
Yeah.
The majority. The majority didn't have insurance, and today the majority have Medicaid. And Medicaid is, you know, a low-paying health insurance, but it's access to life-saving care. Consistently, we've seen that. And we've seen in the states that have accepted the Medicaid expansion, life expectancy has already started to increase. It's hard to imagine many things that have that kind of impact. There are problems with health insurance. It's extraordinarily expensive to get medical care in the United States. There's a lot of room for improvement. But Medicaid is one of the best things we've done. And I would make a strong appeal that we, when we're trying to develop relationships with our neighbors, we have a responsibility and the privilege of caring for our less fortunate neighbors, particularly those who are the indigent ill.
I agree with that. Now, what I've seen as a product of the Medicaid expansion is that people are being able to reenter into society and be productive and have jobs and sustain employment. And if you're not healthy, you can't contribute to society. That's the bottom line.
That's my sense as well. We've had many people on the floor, and I've written about them. I wrote about one of those gentlemen in the Washington Post about how before the Medicaid expansion, his life was one way, and after it's very different. So we know people who are getting and holding work because they're able to get medical care. Medicaid is actually, while it's expensive, while healthcare is expensive, it's ultimately a great deal for society.
Now, for those 5% that do not have the benefits or are not utilized or cannot access the benefits of the Medicaid expansion, what alternatives do those citizens have?
Well, that's the tricky part. The people in that category within Denver and Colorado are mostly people who don't have a legal status and so therefore are excluded from Medicaid. That being said, there are some resources that are still available to them. Under federal law, an emergency room can't turn them away. And then there are community and health organizations that work to care for them even though they can't qualify for Medicaid. Certainly if they can afford commercial insurance, that's another story. But ultimately, we haven't figured out how to provide care for people who aren't here under a clear legal status, whereas some other countries in the world have.
Now, for those men and women who do not have a clear legal status, are they being tracked as John or Jane Doe's when they're being treated into emergency rooms or being taken in for inpatient care or long-term care?
I certainly can't speak to every hospital. Certainly at our hospital, we register people under the name that they give us and the name that we believe to be true for them. We certainly have sometimes when people are a John and Jane Doe, but we want to treat people as themselves. So as soon as we find out their name, we register them under that.
Okay. So even if it's an alias or a pseudonym, you still track that, obviously, as a live person and as a human being.
Sure. My job is to care for people irrespective of their legal status. That's one of the things I love about being a physician is I get to meet people who are very different than me, and I get a chance to try to care for them.
What would you say has been the most rewarding part of being a psychiatric doctor in this field? And you've been in this field for how many years? I think like over 10 years?
I finished residency 8 years ago.
Okay, 8 years ago. And so you've been an acting psychiatrist since?
For 8 years, and then I had 4 years of training before that, so roughly since 2005.
2005, so about 12 years.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I was close.
You were great. You did awesome.
So I would say going forward, you clearly have a passion for this, and you clearly, you know, love people, which is the biggest, attribute to have in the kind of work you do. What would you say is the biggest challenge, though?
For mental health care?
Yes.
Or for the country? I think that the crisis we're facing as a country is that we're not having those kind of chance encounters with people where you get to know them and you get to be surprised. I think there's something terrific about surprise. Meeting somebody who you don't initially think is like you and finding that you have something in common or that they teach you something. I worry about that for society. I think that the growing economic and housing segregation that you see, I think that the way that media divides people into market niches makes it hard to see things differently. We tend to cluster today more and more under these sort of groups or that follow on particular political or economic or racial lines. And I worry for that for society. It's healthy to be surprised.
It is very healthy to be surprised, and it's very healthy to be engaged. Now, you were telling me about a fascinating book that you have been reading that you think is a good read for our listeners who are inclined to do so, and just the general message that it promotes that you wanted to talk about a little bit today before we left.
Absolutely. I've been loving Jonathan Haidt's, H-A-I-D-T's book, The Righteous Mind, and it's a work of moral psychology, and he asks the question, how do people make decisions? And he says, most of us believe that we think through and that our reason guides us. Haidt shows that, in fact, it's emotion that really guides us, that emotion is the master and reason is the servant, that we see people and we make an emotional, quick, intuitive decision in a flash, and then we develop the reasons for it afterwards. And his analysis shows why things like how Republicans and Democrats think differently and how they make different kinds of moral appeals. And he offers some advice to people about how to make successful emotional appeals. One of Haidt's messages is that the way to get out of this kind of righteous mind, which you see on both the left and the right, and ultimately is lazy thinking. And it's the righteous mind is a kind of thinking that discourages you from surprise. He says that the way to get out of that is to develop empathy. And the two big ways that I think you can do that is, one, to improve interpersonal relationships, put down the cell phone, shut off the TV, go meet somebody who surprises you, get to know them. And two is, he says that when you're working with people, to emphasize cooperative rather than competitive goals. And so I think it's a book that I started reading after the election. It's one that frankly had been on my shelf for a while and had never gotten to. And after the election and trying to think through how we wound up here as a country, I made some changes in my life, leaving Twitter, reading this book, interacting with some people in my own life a little differently. And I guess I would say that it's been helpful for me, and I hope it might be helpful to a listener. So I recommend the book, The Righteous Mind.
Well, Doctor, it sounds like a wonderful read. And the message that you are basically conveying today is get out, interact, talk to people who are not like you, challenge yourself, have human interconnection, and try to think outside your box.
Tish, I couldn't have said it better myself. I like to be surprised by people, and I'm grateful for the chance to be surprised by you.
Well, you know what? Your talent and your skills are not a surprise, but having you here in studio has been an absolute joy. And will you come back and visit us later,
you know,
if we need to have you back in the future?
Tish, anytime, and maybe someday you'll let me DJ a set, too. So
I think we can manage that.
Okay.
I think we can manage that. You guys have been listening to the KGNU Community Radio. I am your host, Tish Buford. We have had the wonderful Dr. Abraham Nussbaum from Denver Public Health. He is the chief educator there on staff. Brilliant, very, very fascinating, and very kind gentleman. And it has been our honor to have you in the studio today, and we will love to have you back soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Tish.
Absolutely. Everyone, thank you for listening today. Take care. Stay educated, stay ready, and always stay engaged. Have a great day, and thank you for listening.